Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today's guest, Stephen Greenhouse, covered the labor movement for the New York Times for 19 years. He first looked into unionizing back in 1977, after 18 months at his first newspaper job. Well, four decades later, labor unions and worker power have grown far weaker in the United States than in any other advanced industrial nation. In his new book, Beaten Down, Worked Up, The Past, Present, and Future of American Labor, Stephen Greenhouse writes, quote, "In the United States, a country that by many measures is the world's richest, life has taken a wrong turn for millions of workers. For far too many, the land of opportunity has turned into a land of downsized hopes and shrunken mobility," end quote. As corporate profits and CEO pay reach all-time highs, nearly 50 million Americans make less than $15 an hour and struggle to make ends meet. According to the Federal Reserve, 4 in 10 adults say they don't have enough money to pay an unexpected $400 emergency expense. And according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, 1 in 8 Americans do not have sufficient access to healthy food. So what will it take to turn this around and implement major changes? Today, we're joined by Stephen Greenhouse. He was a reporter in total for the New York Times for 31 years. He is the author of The Big Squeeze, Tough Times for the American Worker, that won a Hillman Prize for book journalism. And his latest is Beaten Down, Worked Up, The Past, Present, and Future of American Labor. And Stephen Greenhouse joins us from New York. Hi, Stephen. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rose. Always great to be here.
Well, it's great to have you, Stephen. Thank you for writing this book. I have to say, the first two chapters are full of so many notes because there's just so much good information in here, and it's pretty daunting. I mean, when you look at the numbers, how things have just shifted so much from the early 70s. When you look at all of that, given that you write about this, you've written about this for years, what do you think really stands out for you when you look at where we are today?
So, you know, I covered labor and workplace matters for the New York Times for nearly 20 years. And, you know, you sit back and say, what's going on? And you see that in many ways, things have gotten worse for workers. A lot of people used to have great pensions. Now they have, a lot of them have mediocre 401ks. You know, I worked at the New York Times for 30 years. My parents held their jobs for 20, 30 years. Now a lot of people, you know, face really precarious jobs, huge instability. You know, wages for the average worker are basically the same as 40, 45 years ago. Things are really broken for workers. And look at the big fight now in California over this new bill regarding Uber and Lyft drivers. I mean, there's huge concern that corporations are trying to kind of squeeze workers by not treating them as employees, but by treating them as independent contractors, which means they don't contribute to your Social Security, they don't provide you with workers' compensation or unemployment insurance, you don't get overtime protections. So, you know, corporations very much have the upper hand nowadays. That's one of the central points of my book, Rose, and that workers are really taking it on the chin. Yes, things are a little better because unemployment is so low and that wages are finally creeping upward. But considering that we're in the 11th year of an economic expansion, wages have hardly budged over those 11 years, and things are really broken for workers. And in this book, I kind of try to sound an alarm that, you know, worker power is way too weak in the United States. Corporate power is too dominant, and we need to do something to improve things for millions of workers.
And we will talk about AB 5, which the Governor Newsom is expected to sign that bill. And you've been tweeting about it. Uber has been tweeting about it, saying that reporters are getting it wrong. We actually invited Uber to join us, but they declined like they always do. We'll talk about that later in the show. Stephen, I mean, on our show and the work that you do, we talk about this regularly and we throw out all these numbers. In your book, for example, the top 1% of households received 22% of the nation's income in 2015, up 9% from 1984. That is the highest percentage the 1% has received since the 1920s. I mean, there are so many incredible statistics in here. But at the end of the day, the fact of the matter is that a small number of people are getting incredibly wealthy, and a large number of people are really struggling to make ends meet. So can we talk about how this happened? I mean, you go over a lot of this in your book. It's not just the Republican Party. It's also the Democratic Party. I mean, a lot of Bill Clinton, a lot of people in the Obama administration, in fact, are saying that neoliberalism did not work and we need to do something different. So let's talk about how we got here.
Fine. So there are several reasons, of course. And one of the main points I make in my book is that when unions were much stronger in the 1940s and 50s and 60s, they did a lot more to lift the standards of typical workers. And I have a devote, you know, two chapters to the United Auto Workers when they were the strongest union in the nation, and the extremely important Flint sit-down strike, which was probably the most important strike of the 20th century, and how that led to mass unionization of the auto workers. And the auto workers were kind of the battering ram in pressuring, forcing companies to pay much better. And that was key to building the world's largest, richest middle class. So the 50s and 60s and even the 70s were a real time of prosperity for American workers. And then things have really, in ways, gotten worse. One reason is that unions have grown far, far weaker. In the 1950s, they represented more than one in three workers. Now they represent 1 in 10, and in the private sector, just 1 in 16. Another reason is globalization. You know, what now, in the 1950s and 60s, we weren't competing with China and India. Now markets are much more open, and you know, when we compete with China to make televisions or washing machines, you know, the much lower wages in China or Mexico or India are going to pull down our wages. But a third thing, Rose, that I think is extremely important and that I feel doesn't get enough attention is that corporate America plays much harder ball, you know, plays super hard ball with its workers compared to 30, 40, 50 years ago. Mm. They fight unions much harder. They focus on profit. They've been focusing on profit maximization for decades and decades. That, you know, I think that's one reason they've kept wages down. That's a reason that job stability has gotten so much lesser. You know, there's, you know, we read about all these mass layoffs and offshoring and outsourcing. And, you know, as a result of unions being weaker, as a result of corporations focusing much more on how do I maximize profits, how do I maximize return to shareholders, you know, workers are really being shafted. And you know, just to make clear, Rose, my book isn't just statistics. I have lots of, I hope, eloquent tales of individual workers. For instance, I write about Terrence Wise, a fast food worker in Kansas City. He, you know, he had a full-time job at Burger King, a full-time job at Pizza Hut. He left his house at 6 a.m. to go to his first job, and he returned, and before his three daughters woke up, he returned home typically around midnight or 1 a.m. after his daughters had gone to sleep, and his daughters would complain to him, "Daddy, we never see you anymore." Mm. And at one point, when one of the fast food companies cut back his hours from full time to half time, so he had 1.5 jobs, you know, he and his family were rendered homeless because he was just making around the minimum wage. And I try to show, you know, the human tales of our, you know, of our low road economy. I was an economics reporter for the New York Times in Paris for 5 years, and it always struck me that many folks in Europe talk about America's low road economy, and they used to sneer at but also feel some sympathy with the idea of, they called them mick jobs. They couldn't believe that people were working and being paid so little and getting so little benefits. So again, in Europe, universal health coverage, you know, health coverage is universal. Everyone's guaranteed at least four weeks paid vacation. Everyone's guaranteed paid parental leave. Everyone's guaranteed paid sick leave. And your typical fast food worker, your McJobs worker, might be making minimum wage or just a little more, not enough to support a family. They don't get paid parental leave. They don't get paid vacations. They don't get paid sick days. And I try to explain in this book through the tales of individual workers, you know, about how American workers in many ways have it far worse than workers in other industrial nations. And I think far too few Americans understand that. And if they understood it, they would fight harder to improve it.
Talking about the United States versus other countries, you write, the U.S. is the only industrial nation in which workers don't have a legal right to paid sick days, although several states and cities have enacted that. Similarly, the U.S. is the only industrial nation not to give workers a legal right to any vacation, paid or unpaid. In France, workers have a legal right to 6 weeks paid vacation a year. In Britain, 28 days. In Germany, 4 weeks. The U.S. is also the only industrial nation that does not have a law guaranteeing paid maternity leave. The average in European nations is more than 20 weeks.
Yes, as I say, Rose, something is very, very broken. I wrote about a McDonald's worker in Chicago named Adriana Alvarez. And, she's bilingual, and she once went down to Buenos Aires in Argentina when there was a big 5-for-15 strike in Argentina. And she met with all these fast food workers there. And they said they get vacation, they get paid sick days. She said, I was so embarrassed. I'm an American worker from the richest nation on earth. And we don't get paid sick days. And the Argentinians were kind of laughing at us. And she said, the Argentine workers get 3, 4, 5 weeks vacation a year. And she says, I work with a bunch of fast food workers, McDonald's workers, who haven't had vacations in 10 years. So, workers in the United States really are getting the short end of the stick in many ways. And I have this phrase in the book, Rose, that I say, America suffers from anti-worker exceptionalism. And that idea has really caught on, and I think people don't realize that in many fundamental ways, even though we're the world's richest nation, American workers are treated far worse. And one of the crazy things is that, by like 75% to 25%, 80 to 20%, Americans support a law to have paid sick days or paid vacation or paid parental leave, but it ain't going nowhere in Congress, because corporations have so much sway over the politics there.
Today we are speaking with former New York Times labor reporter Stephen Greenhouse. He worked for the New York Times for 31 years. He covered labor and the workplace for 19. His latest book is called Beaten Down, Worked Up, The Past, Present, and Future of American Labor. If you have any questions or comments for Stephen about labor, where we are now, what it will take to get out of this and embrace major change, we'd love to hear from you. If you have any questions or comments about the independent contractor bill, we'd love to hear from you. Stephen also tweeted about a New York Times piece focusing on yoga teachers at Yoga Works in New York who are talking about unionizing. And so there's so much activity going on with farm workers, the fight for 15. Stephen writes about the Los Angeles Alliance for a New Economy. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. We have an email from Carolyn. She says, what can we as voters do to change the image of unions or just fair labor practices? I had a union job in college, which enabled me to go to college and eat. I really don't understand why the image of unions and just plain fair wages and benefits is expected. I'm also very glad about the bill that says Uber and the like has to consider drivers as employees. What can we do to change the public perception?
That's a great question. We can do many things. I think unions, first and foremost, have to do a better job explaining, their role in history and all that they've achieved. I love the bumper sticker, unions, the folks who brought you the weekend. People don't understand enough about what unions have accomplished. I think we as citizens should help make sure that our schools teach, what unions have done, what unions have accomplished. I often wonder, in the anti-union South in Texas and Mississippi and Alabama, do the schools even teach what unions have accomplished? I grew up in New York. I went to schools in New York, and we learned some about unions, about how they ended sweatshops and made coal mines safer and helped achieve the middle class and the 40-hour work week. But I fear that not enough Americans know about that, that too few students learn about that. And I think one thing we can do is help make sure our schools teach more of that. And also, it's really interesting that in this year's presidential race, the candidates are speaking a whole lot about labor how to make unions stronger, how to increase worker power, how to lift workers. I covered labor for over 20 years. I've never before seen candidates talking so much about unions and helping workers, and that's great. And you know, one party really seems very eager to raise the minimum wage, to enact paid sick days, to enact paid parental leave, and it's talking about these important issues. And the other party keeps saying, oh, these are terrible ideas. They'll hurt employers. We can't stand employer mandates. They'll drive all these companies out of business. Again, you know, I was a reporter in Europe for 5 years. I wrote stories in Germany and France and Spain and Denmark, and they have all these good things like paid sick days and paid parental leave, and there are a lot of businesses there doing very fine, thank you. So I think it's important to make clear that, you know, unions and basic employee protections like paid parental leave and paid sick days, you know, can really help workers without being threatening to corporations or society.
Since you're talking about what is happening overseas, and you gave the example of McDonald's workers overseas who have higher pay and better benefits than McDonald's workers in the United States, for example, can you talk about how that happened?
Great question. So I did a story with a colleague, and we explained that McDonald's workers in Denmark averaged over $20 an hour, while here in the United States, this was like a few years ago, they're averaging only about $8 an hour. And that article blew lots of people's minds. Like, how did McDonald's workers in Denmark get $20 an hour? And I should point out that Big Macs don't cost much more in Denmark than they do in the United States. People would say if you raise pay to $15 or $20 for fast food workers, the price of Big Macs will skyrocket. Well, they didn't in Denmark. So how did that happen in Denmark? How did that happen? You know, how did the workers in Argentina get all these great benefits? There's something called industry-wide bargaining, where like the union bargains for all the fast food workers in the country, all the steel workers in the country, all the retail workers in the country. And that gives the unions much more power. They sit down at the table with a group of employers, and often the government, you know, puts its thumb on the scale to make sure things come out more fairly. Here in the United States, there really isn't industry-wide bargaining. It's bargaining often by workplace to workplace, you know, this one store, or maybe, you know, the five factories for this company. And as a result of having this kind of individualized bargaining, you know, by one store or, you know, these five stores, rather than a company-wide, industry-wide, it really puts American workers in a much weaker position.
So let's talk about McDonald's for a minute, Stephen. According to Forbes, McDonald's CEO Stephen Easterbrook made almost $22 million last year. I mean, the thing is, it sounds like you can't even wrap your head around that, but this is kind of common for CEO pay now. Almost $22 million. McDonald's stock is currently trading at $213 per share. So if you live in a state that has the federal minimum wage, you're making $7.25 an hour. Now, what we always hear from these companies is, especially like McDonald's, for example, oh, if the fight for 15 succeeds and we have to pay our workers $15 an hour, the cost of your hamburger is going to go up. So can you talk about this? If McDonald's decided to double their workers' pay, especially where they're making $7 an hour, what would that mean? That their profits go down and maybe their CEO makes $15 million instead of $21
million? No, I think if their labor costs go up, yes, to some degree, their prices will rise. The prices won't double because labor costs represent only maybe 20% of their costs. But, you know, their costs will go up to consumers. And some people argue, as you see with Uber and Lyft right now, that they say that the low wages, the low pay, subsidizes consumers, and consumers are buying hamburgers, you know, their dollar meals, or getting Uber rides perhaps cheaper than they should because workers are being unfairly squeezed. And I imagine, you know, one of the things that's really broken is how CEO pay is so out of control. There was a recent study showing that since 1978, CEO pay is up 940%, which means it's increased by more than 10 times, while pay for the average worker is up just 12% after inflation over the past 40 years. So something's crazy. And again, one of the things I point out in my book is that, you know, again, you know, World War II, unions and business worked hand in hand to defeat a common enemy, the, you know, the Nazis, Japan, the Axis powers. And in the 1950s and 60s, there was really pretty good cooperation between management and business. And I think that stemmed in part from, like, you know, the son of the banker and the son of the steelworker or the son of the farmer, they fought in the trenches together, so that when the son of the banker became a CEO, he was going to watch out for the sons of the farmers and the sons of the steelworkers. I think there was more solidarity in American society. And I think we see, I think the CEOs of today feel much less concern or solidarity with, you know, the poor, the lesser among us. And I think part of that is they feel humongous pressure from Wall Street and hedge funds and private equity funds to maximize profits. And that has really hurt workers. And, you know, and it's sad, I feel, that, you know, many CEOs worry that if they raise pay significantly, you know, Wall Street's going to be pissed off at them. Wall Street's going to say, you're a weak leader, that you really want to, you know, push it to the max and holding down wages. And it's interesting that finally, the Business Roundtable, a group of the CEOs of 200 of the largest companies, finally said, you know, this whole idea of profit maximization only serving shareholders is wrong. We want to change that. We want to do more to serve communities and workers. And it's great they say that, you know, after the horrible, you know, opiate scandal, after all these companies are denying that there's global warming, after workers have really taken it on the chin for years and years. But I worry that when the Business Roundtable says this, it's just window dressing, it's just lip serving, you know, service. We really want to see them take more action to create a fairer economy. Sometimes I say, if they're really serious about not focusing so much on profit maximization, these 200 CEOs should write to President Trump and say, Mr. Trump, please repeal the $1 trillion in tax cuts that we really didn't need because we already had record profits.
Before we go to break, Stephen, since you were talking about CEOs, what about high-level corporate executives who are Democrats? I mean, a number of high-level Obama officials went to work for these companies. For example, Robert Gibbs, who was Obama's communications officer, is now chief vice president for McDonald's. A number of high-level Obama officials work for Uber and Lyft. Valerie Jarrett, senior advisor to Obama, is on the board of Lyft. You know, there's just a long list of Democrats, high-level Democrats, who work for these corporations now. What are your thoughts on that?
So, you know, we live, like it or not, we live in a capitalist economy, and people, when they leave government, you know, a lot of them want to cash in. You know, we wish that they were doing more, you know, maybe less to make investors richer and more to help society at large. I think the bigger picture, Rose, is, you know, the Democratic Party, and has it done enough to help workers? And as I was saying, this year in the campaign, Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, you know, are really fighting hard for workers. You know, Beto O'Rourke and Pete Buttigieg have put out these wonderful platforms about how to help workers and help unions. And we're seeing a lot more than that. And I think, you know, a big reason Hillary Clinton lost in 2016 and a big reason Donald Trump won was that Trump was speaking to blue-collar workers. He says, I'm going to fight for you. I'm going to bring back the jobs. You know, factories aren't going to close on my watch. And Hillary, I'm sorry to say, was, you know, focusing a little too much on Hollywood celebrities and you know, Wall Street donors. And you know, she never went to Wisconsin during the campaign. And I think, you know, she was focusing, people say that the Democrats were focusing too much on the professional class and not enough on FDR's blue collar. And I interviewed some workers who said, you know, some said, I love Donald Trump. He's going to bring back the jobs. He's going to help us on trade. And I spoke to other workers who said, you know, I realize Donald Trump is a liar. I realize he's a con man, but he is speaking on our issues and he shows he cares about us. So despite whatever qualms they had about Trump and his honesty, some of them voted for Trump over Hillary. And I think in this campaign, the Democratic candidates understand that you know, we have to reach out to blue collar workers if we're going to win. And more than that, they realize that to turn around the three key states that delivered victory to Trump, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, they have to not just speak to blue collar workers on their issues like becoming tougher on trade and providing more training for the factory workers who get laid off, but they realize it's important to try to strengthen unions and expand the size of unions, because that will help win in the Midwest. In my book, I explain that, you know, Scott Walker declared war on public sector unions. He really tried to cut them off at the knees. And unions in Wisconsin have lost 177,000 members, 43% of their members in the past decade. And guess what? Trump won Wisconsin by 22,000 votes. Union membership had fallen by 177,000. In Michigan, union membership fell by about 140,000. Trump won Michigan by 11,000. So I think people realize if you strengthen unions, if you expand unions, if unions have more money in their treasury to campaign, that could help the Democrats in a big way.
We're going to take a quick break. We're speaking with Stephen Greenhouse, former labor reporter for The New York Times. He's out with a new book called Beaten Down, Worked Up, The Past, Present, and Future of American Labor. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW, a show that relies on engaged listeners. You can join today's conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's toll-free, 866-798-8255. You can also post a comment or question at yourcallradio.org. You can send us a tweet at yourcallradio. You can send us an email to yourcall@kalw.org. Samantha Power will be Joshua Johnson's guest on 1A. She's been UN ambassador and on Obama's National Security Council. She has a new memoir called Education of an Idealist. Samantha Power on 1A, 1/2 hour from now at 11 o'clock.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are speaking with Stephen Greenhouse, former labor reporter for The New York Times, who's out with a new book, Beaten Down, Worked Up, The Past, Present, and Future of American Labor. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Let's hear from Ariane in San Francisco. Hi, welcome to the show.
Hello, thank you for taking my call. I just want to make a comment about political maturity and the impact of being in touch with unions at the workplace, because it allows the workplace to be democratized. And in this country, we've had a problem with people being complacent and satiated with all the things you can buy and all the gadgets one can have. But it's a different kind of experience, a maturing kind of experience, when one interacts with a union at one's workplace, where one spends most of one's adult life. And it encourages people to become more politically mature and responsible, and to consider that maybe the places, the things that are happening outside of the workplace, like gross economic injustice and the ravaging and pillaging of foreign nations and our planet, that that's totally unacceptable, as our planet has rights, that our environment has rights, that other nations and other peoples who have different ways of thinking than us also have rights. And it also uses consensual decision making, which is slow going and arduous at times, but totally accelerates the evolutionary arc of individuals. So that's why it's been suppressed so radically. You can't have the 10% controlling most of the wealth in this country and a unionized workforce.
Well, thank you for calling in, Ariane. We'll get a comment in a minute, but let's just go to another caller. Let's hear from Greg in San Francisco. Hi, Greg. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. I just want to say, you know, I was wondering if the author actually looked at, you know, population growth. You know, we had, you know, so much migration to the country and undocumented people having children, and those children, those neighborhoods that those children are living in not being invested in so that those kids can, you know, get higher paying jobs. You know, I moved to San Francisco over 28 years ago. I had a starting position in San Francisco, South Fifth Avenue, making $15 an hour. And now, today, San Francisco has a minimum wage of $15 an hour. And I can surely tell you nothing is the same price. And so now they're doing the same thing with saturating the market with, you know, white-collar workers where we're importing or, you know, like bringing so many people over on visas, which is driving down, you know, salaries for people that are like engineers and coders and all the rest, even though the cost of education keeps going up, the salaries are going down. You know, I know people that have been engineers for their professional life, and if they were walking into the workforce today, they would actually make less today than they did when they started. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's just, you know, the saturation of the market that is being influenced by, again, big money and these corporations wanting to reduce their cost of labor, and unfortunately our, you know, our politicians being in their pockets are allowing it.
Greg, you worked at Saks Fifth Avenue how long ago for $15 an hour?
28 years ago.
They paid you $15 an hour 28 years
to
ago.
Start.
Wow.
Yeah, to start.
Wow. Well, thank you for calling in. Your comments, Stephen?
First, if you're making $15 an hour 28 years ago, Greg, I'll just say wow. that's great. So first, you know, so in this book I write, you know, I describe how Walt Disney brought in 150 engineers from India and laid off 150 workers and said, sorry, we don't need you anymore. And how, you know, bringing in people on these visas can really hurt American workers and pull down wages. In my previous book, The Big Squeeze, I focused much more on, you know, the 50 different methods corporations use to push down wages. One of them is to bring in immigrant workers. Sometimes it's to use, immigrant workers to break strikes. In this book, I try to do something really different. I try to, you know, as I said, I feel far too few people understand what unions do, what they've achieved, especially young people. So I've tried to write a book, kind of a handy one-volume book explaining the rise of unions, how important they've been in American history, the many things they've accomplished. You know, building the middle class. I write about the Memphis sanitation worker strike and how that was a landmark for both labor rights and civil rights. And I talk about the decline of unions and how, you know, and the many reasons that unions have declined, largely, you know, because of globalization and corporations declaring and Republicans declaring war on unions. And I write about how that has taken, the decline of unions has taken a serious toll, helping fuel decades of wage stagnation, helping cause income inequality in the U.S. to be the worst it's been since the roaring 1920s, and helping create a really warped system where the Koch brothers and large corporations have had way too much sway over our politics and our policymaking when workers don't have nearly enough power. And I think Ariane made a very good point that unions do help educate workers, and there are, you know, academic studies showing that people in labor unions are better informed about politics than about policy, that people in labor unions are more active in politics, they tend to vote more. Other studies show that, you know, when you're active in a union, you might be involved in bargaining, you might stand up to the boss, you might go to union meetings where you speak up, and that you become more assertive and more active in politics. And you know, again, there are studies showing that when unions decline, the percentage of people who vote in various states decline. So unions can really help, help educate people better, help people understand the problems better. I've heard many people say that if unions represented 35% of the workforce as it did in the 1950s and not 10% as it is now, there's no way in the world Donald Trump would have won, because unions would have explain to millions and millions of workers that, you know, this guy really isn't a friend of workers. And you know, the crazy thing is, you know, Donald Trump, you know, many Americans feel that the system is rigged, and the system is rigged in many ways against workers. And Trump said, I'm going to fix the system. I know it's rigged. So we elected Trump, and he's done dozens of things to rig the system further against workers. And that's really, you know, really a tragedy that's really hard to fix. Although in November 2020, there'll be a chance to change that.
We have an email from Carolyn who wanted to respond to our last caller. She said the reason the caller was making $15 an hour 28 years ago was because the retail unions were very strong. So Saks Fifth Avenue, although non-union, had to pay the going rate. She writes, I also made $15 per hour 28 years ago. I worked at J. Magnin, which was union, and when they closed, I was recruited by Saks, and they had to pay me the union wage.
That's a good point. You know, yep. I've written stories about the janitorial industry in Los Angeles. Mm. And, you know, 30 years ago, it was highly unionized. And then there was all this contracting out to get around unions, to circumvent unions. And they started paying workers, you know, one-third of what the unionized workers faced. And I think we've seen some of the same in retail as well. And when unions were strong, they provided a bigger floor. In the book, I explain how, in 1950, Walter Reuther and the United Auto Workers reached this landmark agreement with General Motors. General Motors was eager to spend tens of billions of dollars to expand because all these people had come back from the war. We were building the national highway system. The suburbs were developing. People were going to need to drive more, buy many more cars, and GM wanted to expand, but it was worried that the union would gum up the works by going on strike. So they reached this landmark agreement that basically promised 20% raises after inflation over 5 years. And imagine getting a real increase in your pay of 20%. And they provided much better health care and much better pensions. And the historians write that this contract was really the key element in helping create the middle class because yes, other unions demanded the same thing, the steel workers, the rubber workers. But importantly, this union contract became a model for many non-union companies because those companies wanted to keep out the union. Those companies wanted to attract good workers. And they realized, hey, if we want to attract good workers, if we want to keep out a union, we have to kind of do what GM has promised to UAW. So when unions were strong, they lifted not just union members, but they lifted non-union members as well. I think that's what Greg and Carolyn said about Saks. When unions were strong, they really created high standards. Mm.
Today we're speaking with Stephen Greenhouse about his new book, Beaten Down, Worked Up, The Past, Present, and Future of American Labor. Stephen was a reporter for the New York Times for 31 years, and he covered labor for 19. If you have a question or comment about workers' rights, where we are right now, how we got here, and how to implement major change, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. If you have a personal story to share about your workplace, worker pay, we'd love to hear from you. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Since you're telling that story, Stephen, we have a few emails from listeners saying, what happened to unions? One listener writes, how did employers get away with smearing the unions and turning workers away from them? Did the unions of the 50s and 60s contribute to this corruption, or is that a myth? Did the unions make other mistakes we need to know about to avoid them today, or did employers simply amass enough wealth and power to grab the power away?
In ways, both. And I'm sorry that, in the 1950s and 60s, there was a whole lot of corruption in unions. There's much less today. But in the 1950s, union corruption was, a very big story. The Teamsters and the longshoremen, especially the East Coast longshoremen, were very corrupt. The West Coast longshoremen were very enlightened and progressive. But the East Coast longshoremen, many people have seen the movie On the Waterfront, and there was huge corruption and the federal government did a major investigation. The Senate held major hearings about union corruption, and that really weakened popularity and approval for unions. So unions shot themselves in the foot that way. And also in the 1970s and 80s, unions didn't do nearly enough organizing. They thought, we steel workers are making good money, we construction workers are making good money, we auto workers are making good money, we don't have to go out and organize. And they didn't realize that the ground was growing weaker below their feet. So one reason unions got weaker was that unions didn't do enough organizing. And in the 1980s, manufacturing really lost a ton of jobs in the United States because of recession and because of this flood of imports coming in from the Japanese automobiles, steel from many countries, TVs were increasingly made abroad. and manufacturing had long been the base of unions. And we went from having 19.5 million manufacturing jobs to 12.5 million. We lost 40% of our manufacturing jobs. It's really hobbled unions. And once labor, organized labor's manufacturing base got much weaker, that helped weaken labor overall. And also, you know, in the 1980s, President Reagan fired these over 11,000 air traffic controllers who engaged in an illegal strike, and that really set labor back on its heels, and that gave a green light to corporations to become much more aggressive in fighting against unions. So that's why, you know, far more retail workers were unionized 30 years ago, far higher percentage than is the case today. And Walmart has been extremely anti-union, and Target has been extremely anti-union. So the unions haven't done enough to unionize them. But even if they tried, it would be very hard because these big companies have grown so sophisticated and aggressive in beating back unions.
Since you brought up those companies and their aggressive tactics, there have been articles about, for example, Costco's CEO, who sets his pay much lower than other comparable CEOs and pays workers higher. Can you point to some companies that actually do treat their workers with respect and dignity and pay them a living wage?
Yes. In my previous book, The Big Squeeze, I have a big chapter in Costco, which is really a wonderful model company in how they treat their workers. You know, generally, you know, someone who's worked at Costco for 5 years is essentially earning twice as much as someone who works at Walmart for 5 years, and they're getting much better benefits and treatment at Costco. Patagonia, another California, you know, company, also treats its workers extremely well. I have a part of my chapter about Kaiser Permanente, the nation's oldest and biggest labor management partnership. It generally, since this partnership was created in the mid-1990s, has done a very good job giving workers a strong voice in operations, helping, create great cooperation and sharing of ideas between management and workers to improve service, to hold down costs, and to improve pay. Now, I realize right now, Rose, there's a big fight going on between some of Kaiser Permanente's unions and Kaiser. They say, Kaiser Permanente has gotten greedy, that it's making too much money and not sharing enough with the workers. And, there is this unfortunate labor dispute now. But over the past 25 years, generally, Kaiser Permanente has really been one of the very best companies in terms of showing respect for workers, including them in decision making, paying them better than most other healthcare systems.
Right, because Kaiser Permanente Colorado workers just voted overwhelmingly to authorize a nationwide strike. According to the Denver Post, 96% of those who voted support the strike, and we've had on a number of therapists who've gone on strike. They say that patients have to wait up to 6 weeks to get an appointment.
And so, as I said, generally, you speak to many academics, they'll say Kaiser has generally been the best labor management partnership in the country. But, the heads of some of the unions, some of these workers say that Kaiser Permanente has taken a wrong turn the past 2 years, that it's emphasizing profits too much and it's not doing enough to improve service. It's not doing enough to raise pay. I don't know, who's exactly right on that. I'd say from 1995 to 2015, all these academics are writing studies of Kaiser Permanente saying this is one of the best companies in the country and how it treats its workers. Now, some of the unions are saying it's really taken a wrong turn. It's gotten greedier. And we'll see how this plays out.
We have an email from Howard who says, thank you for focusing on this subject. I believe that the economic oppression of American workers is a root cause of many social ills. As a taxi driver, I saw many, many men who played by the rules, endured working as independent contractors, and invested their retirement savings in medallions that quickly became almost worthless when Uber and Lyft were allowed to operate in San Francisco. I remember one saying, what the hell do they expect us to do, sell drugs? When men are stripped of their role as providers and protectors and lose the dignity that comes from having work, they're left feeling empty and alienated from everyone around them. Their wrath is fully justified, and that wrath can be seen in everything from the decline in life expectancy, gun violence, suicide rates. You know, I've been wanting to do a show about that topic, actually. What are your thoughts on this, Stephen?
So I have a chapter about the gig economy and how, in many ways, it seems devised to squeeze workers unfairly. You know, I realize that a lot of people think the gig economy is good. It gives workers more opportunities. It gives workers more flexibility. If you're not making enough money on your full-time 40-hour-a-week job, maybe you work at Mechanical Turk or Uber for 5 or 10 hours to supplement your income. And it's on one hand very good that people have these additional opportunities, but you know, I've explained in my chapter on the gig economy, you know, too often these jobs pay, you know, just $4, $5, $6 an hour, and that there are a lot of, you know, too many people chasing after not enough work, and I think that's one of the problems many Uber drivers face, is they're not making enough money per hour. They're working 60 hours a week, 70 hours a week, you know, killing themselves trying to support their families. And, you know, and yes, about taxi drivers, many of them, you know, invested a lot in medallions, and then all these Uber drivers come in, don't even have to buy medallions, and they really push down the value of medallions, push down the value of, you know, push down how much taxi drivers can work. And, you know, one of the points I make in my book is that, you know, what's happening with gig workers, many of them are not making a living. In many ways, you know, a lot of the gig economy, which people say is so great for workers, it greatly favors companies and doesn't do enough for workers. And I think, you know, what we've seen in California the past few days with the enactment of AB 5, which basically says Uber drivers and Lyft drivers should be treated as employees rather than independent contractors, and they'll thus be protected by minimum wage laws as employees. They'll get paid overtime as employees. The companies will have to provide unemployment insurance and workers' comp coverage. The workers will be protected from, you know, race discrimination, sexual harassment laws. You know, that these are efforts to respond to what many people see as basic unfairnesses in the gig economy.
Can we talk about a success story? You dedicate a chapter in your book to the Culinary Union, which is based in Las Vegas. And as you point out, they have organized, they've held strikes, they've done an amazing job of mobilizing, they have negotiated really good contracts. Housekeepers in Las Vegas average over about $19 an hour compared to $11 around the country, for example. So tell us more about the Culinary Union.
I'm glad you asked that, Rose. You know, so I have a few chapters about the rise of unions and how they created the middle class, and then a few chapters about the unfortunate decline of unions and how that's hurt workers. But I wanted to make clear that there are some unions, you know, out there now that are doing a great job in lifting workers. The Culinary Union in Las Vegas, in an era when many unions have lost members, it's gone from 18,000 members in the late 1980s to it's more than tripled in size since then. And I profile a hotel housekeeper at MGM Grand, an immigrant from Honduras. She makes $19.50 an hour, and under the contract, they're guaranteed 40 hours a week. So that means they're guaranteed like $780 a week, which is basically $40,000 a year, which for housekeepers is pretty damn good. And for non-union housekeepers, the average pay is just $11 an hour. And in many non-union hotels, they just give the housekeepers 25 hours, 30 hours a week. So they might make, you know, $350, $400 a week. They make less than $20,000 a year. Try living on that. So the hotel workers and the members of the Culinary Union make a good living. It's done a wonderful job raising all these dishwashers and housekeepers into the middle class. And the woman I profile in that chapter, Frances Garcia, has three kids. Her husband moved back to Honduras when he couldn't find construction jobs, but she's been able to raise three kids in Las Vegas on her own. She has a great health care plan. She doesn't have to pay any premiums. She's getting a good pension, and she's been so happy about the union that she's gotten very involved as a shop steward. And she, like, is a shop steward for 20 workers in her hotel. She goes to bat for them if they try to punish various workers. You know, she gets involved in political campaigns, and you know, it's one of the most politically active unions in the country. Many people say it played the decisive role in flipping Nevada from red to blue in 2016, while Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania flipped from blue to red. Mm-hmm. Nevada was an important state that flipped from red to blue, and that's because the culinary union did such a great job mobilizing, you know, thousands of workers to knock on doors and get their neighbors to vote. So the culinary union, and it also does a wonderful job training. You know, someone could be a busser who picks up dirty dishes, and that person could take a free course to become a chef, even a sommelier. They could double or triple their pay thanks to the free training that's provided by the Culinary Institute, which is a joint effort of the union and the hotels out there. So the culinary union kind of does everything right, and it really is a model for other unions about how to raise living standards for workers, how to involve workers, how to give them a stronger voice, and how unions can really kick ass in politics.
What would you say is the major difference between the culinary union and other unions, say other unions that are struggling?
It's done a lot more to mobilize its workers. It's a lot more militant. It really has a history of strikes and doesn't really put up with much employer BS. And it's really set a very high floor, and it's done a great job maintaining and protecting that floor. When some casinos come and try to attack that floor, it fights very hard. You know, it threatens strikes. It does great public relations to put companies on the defensive. It's a very sophisticated union that probably has the best shop steward network, you know, one of the best systems of like mobilizing and educating members, of, you know, knocking on their doors, of talking to them about politics, not just in the month before the election, but, you know, all year long. And that's why it really is a mobilized, educated union. And it's, you know, half the union is immigrants.
Stephen, I hate to ask you this because we're almost out of time, but your last chapter, How Workers Can Regain Their Power. Just given all the years you've spent on this, what are your thoughts at a time when inequality is widening and we went all over all the statistics, but can you just summarize that chapter for us?
Sure. So I make various recommendations on how to rebuild worker power and make things better for workers. My last third of the book looks at various models for expanding worker power, the red for red teacher strikes in Arizona and Los Angeles and elsewhere, how successful the Fight for 15 was in getting California and other states to vote a $15 minimum wage, about a great farm workers group in Florida that's done wonders raising standards for 35,000 tomato pickers. In my last chapter, I look at, you know, strategies to make things better for workers. You know, we need laws to make it easier to unionize. But there's so much opposition in Congress among Republicans to helping unions that I say we really need to fix our public finance system, which I believe is way too broken. Mm. Corporations and the Koch brothers and Sheldon Adelson have way too much power, way too much sway. And as a result, our system is really skewed in favor of the rich and not in favor of workers. And I think we need more public financing so that we don't have the Koch brothers having, you know, a gazillion times as much say as the typical school teacher or Walmart worker or steel worker or Uber driver. I think
Stephen Greenhouse is a reporter was a labor reporter with the New York Times. His latest book is Beaten Down, Worked Up, The Past, Present, and Future of American Labor. Thank you so much for joining us, Stephen. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.